Good afternoon. So last time we started by finishing up talking about some networking topics. So we talked about Nat a bit, I believe, which will, because of the quiz question, I'll talk a little about that more, and I believe auto configuration. And then we started talking about sort of our main topic for last time and today, which was security. So we mentioned we had these security properties. And we were focusing on confidentiality and authenticity of these sort of things we wanted to provide. And we were using these kind of mathematical tools to help us do so when communicating over some insecure network. And by an insecure network, we have these attackers, and we had these kind of two different models for our attackers. We had eavesdroppers, and we had the active machine in the middle. And to address our problem of confidentiality and authenticity, we had kind of two tools, one targeted at confidentiality and one targeted at authenticity, that we started with. And these were both based on these shared secrets. So we have these shared secrets, which were symmetric keys. And we had encryption. This is symmetric encryption that provided confidentiality. And we had message authentication codes, which I'll abbreviate as MAC, which provided authenticity. And the idea in both of these is that without the shared secret, you can't break the confidentiality or the authenticity requirement. You can't learn about the encrypted data if you don't already know it without the key. You can't learn, you can't sort of forge the message authentication code without the key, no matter what information you have. And then we started to introduce schemes that weren't based on shared secrets, but were based on this public key slash private key idea, where the idea was that instead of having, you know, a shared secret with each person we're communicating with, we have one secret, and we have some public information derived from that we can broadcast to absolutely everyone. And we introduced sort of asymmetric encryption, where with the public key, you can do the operation everyone should be able to do, which is, for asymmetric encryption, encrypt stuff to you. You want everyone to do that. And with the private key, you know, you can decrypt, but not everyone should be able to do that. So that requires the private key, and the model for how we use this is that we keep the private key with ourselves, and we give the public key out to absolutely everyone, and that should be fine. So questions about things we covered last time before I move on? I will talk about some of the quiz questions, and maybe we'll have some more questions about things we covered last time. Okay, so the first question on the quiz was about the NAT, and I had neglected to consider that so in previous semesters, I guess, I covered more of the networking layers and what they do. I've deliberately cut that back for time this semester and wasn't thinking carefully about how that affected that quiz question. But the sort of central thing that that quiz question was trying to get you to think of is that, you know, the idea of network address translation is that we have this private network And it goes through this router, and we have our router's IP. And in the private network, it looks like we're actually communicating, you know, kind of directly with that other, the outside network, with our private IP. That's the illusion we want to provide, is that even though we're actually using the router's IP, we want it to look like we're using our private network IP. And so the router just translates the private IP to its IP going out and coming in. It looks like we're talking, quote unquote, directly to the remote server, possibly across the internet. Of course, that's going through a whole bunch of routers, including the one that changes those addresses and ones that do the normal thing and don't change any addresses. So inside the network, when we're communicating to something that's on the other side of the router, we never see the router's IP address. We just see, oh, we're talking to that other network, and the routers, as they usually are kind of transparent to us. We just send the IP address we want, and the routers make that work. And that was why on the quiz, the correct answer was none of the above, because we shouldn't change the source address. And this is important for sockets. So when you connect, when you make your socket, you connected it to a particular IP address to do that. And the OS, when it's receiving packets, is going to expect that IP address to match in order to send the data it got from that server to your socket. So if we change the IP addresses, that match wouldn't happen anymore. Change the source IP address. When it got to the machine on the private network, that machine would say, this isn't my packet. Or this isn't a packet for that connection. It's a packet for something else. It goes to me, but it's not for my connection. And it would not handle it properly. And something which I guess makes this confusing, which is the main reason I gave credit for other options on the quiz question, is that, if we're sending stuff to a particular machine in the local network, don't we need to say where it comes from on the local network, not just on the internet? And the answer is yes, but that's not done with IP addresses. We didn't talk about that in detail, so we won't test you about that, but that's sort of the other reason why we can't put the router's address in the source IP address, is because that's not IP addresses, like, because it's supposed to go across the internet, we don't change them each hop of the transmission. We do that with something on a lower layer, which doesn't deal with IP addresses. So that's... okay, so that's our talk about that. So we should use an unaltered source address, but we should just change the destination address, which was none of the above on that question. So the other question people had trouble with on the quiz was related to what encryption does for confidentiality versus authenticity. That we had a bunch of cases where we were talking about a machine in the middle attacker, and we were asking, could they change these things in the form post the user made or received? And if we looked at how they were transmitted, they were encrypted with symmetric encryption and not authenticated in any way. There was no message authentication code. And we said that we're kind of assuming what is unfortunately the most common thing when you hear about encryption, which is that it's only going to provide confidentiality. It's not going to protect against manipulation. So very trivially, in that scheme, the machine in the middle can just corrupt the encrypted data. And it's going to turn out to be something. So we'll get some corrupted version. And more maybe competently, the attacker could selectively corrupt it to manipulate it to something that is either something they've chosen if they can guess what the original message was, or at least something, you know, where they'll have some idea what the result of their manipulation will be because they know, oh, they're flipping certain bits, so here are the possible results given what, you know, the, for example, the names of the forums or the contents of the posts could have been. So questions about that? Yes?
I guess I'm just really confused by what exactly it means to change, like, the forum that something is sent to. Like, sure, you could corrupt it and just have it send data that makes no sense, but if you wanted to change the forum, you need to change it to a precise forum, right?
So the question, if you wanted to change the form, you need to change it to a precise form. So I would argue if we're sending it to a form whose name is garbage, that's a different form. Like, is this going to work? No, but there's a way for it to fail. The other answer I'd say is that if we can guess what form it was originally sent to, we mentioned that with the schemes we talked about, like, we know that there's a bunch of encryption schemes where if we have the encryption of some message, I guess, with a key and some message ends up being, you know, we had this scheme where we had a counter and something we generated XORed with the message, right? Remember that from last time? So in that case, if we can guess that the beginning of the message is, you know, form XYZ, well, we could change that to form ABC by XORing it with the result difference that flips the right bits to change XYZ to ABC.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, something, and the attacker could try to do that by just, if they know the name of one of the forms, they can just hope this post is for that form and try changing it that way. So that would be a viable strategy for that. And something they can do, which I guess we didn't talk about last time, but like might be a better version of that, is that let's say they have like 1,000 guesses for the names of the forms. Something they could do is they could take the message, generate all 1,000 variants for the flipping the bits from each of those possible names to the one they want, and send all of them.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, so
I guess, like, I maybe should have said, my intention was that the main way you'd answer the question is you'd say, it's a different form name, it doesn't matter if it's valid.
Okay.
That was my intention. My intention wasn't that you realize that this was also possible, but, like, it's also possible that they can direct it in a very meaningful way, very plausibly. But my intention was you'd say, oh, there's a different form name, it doesn't matter that it's junk. So I'll need to think about if we want to change credit for that. Because my thought was that you'd say, you know, just like if I said write to a different file, right, you'd say it doesn't matter if the file name is junk, right, it's still a different file. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, other questions? Okay. So let's pick up in talking about, we talked about asymmetric encryption last time. So we had our public key and our private key. So our private key we keep secret, public key we give to everyone. And we mentioned that, you know, the use of this approximately looks like symmetric encryption, right? When we want to send a message to someone, we encrypt it. And when we want to decrypt it, we use the decrypt operation. The only difference is that this is going to be inherently one way because one party is going to have the private key, the other is going to have the public key. And also, like, because the public key can be distributed to everybody, you know, the decryption procedure is going to be the same no matter who you receive it from. It's the same key. And just like in our symmetric encryption example, this only really provides confidentiality. And that's actually more of a problem here. So with symmetric encryption, we need to do this like funny bit flipping thing and hope the encryption algorithm works in a particular way. Here we don't need that. If we want to generate a message that says the secret formula is something else, everyone knows the public key is kind of our assumption. And if everyone knows the public key, our machine in the middle can just generate, they can run on, they can generate anything encrypted to A. Like, they don't need any funny tricks of guessing what the old message was. They can just run PE. They have all the information needed to do that because it's a public key. So we're definitely going to want some way of doing authentication here, verifying who the message comes from and that it wasn't tampered with. And we could do that with message authentication codes, but that's kind of unsatisfying because we've kind of reintroduced our key distribution problem. We could actually solve our key distribution problem because we have a way of encrypting things now, but what we'll more often do is we'll use kind of the asymmetric equivalent of message authentication codes, which is digital signatures. And what digital signatures are going to do is they're going to give us a way of having another public-private key pair, where again, the private key we will keep to ourselves, we will never share it with anyone, and the private key will let us generate a signature. And a signature is going to serve the same purpose as a tap. Now, we can't do the thing we did with message authentication codes of just comparing the signature to one we generate again, because then you could generate a signature for anything. So instead, we're going to supply this verify function that's going to take the public key, and it's going to tell you if it was a correct signature or not. So our mathematical experts are going to construct these functions S and V in some way of generating a public-private key pair. We're going to tell everyone about this public key, which is going to let everyone run the verify function. Everyone's going to be able to verify that we, yes, called the sign function with the private key in that value. And because of the mathematical construction, if you don't have the private key, you can't generate a signature where V will return 1 for something that you, if you don't already have it. Questions about kind of our basics of what this digital signature scheme is before we start using it. Okay, so our basic use is similar to the message authentication code case. So we generate our private and public key. We send our public key to everyone, just like in asymmetric encryption, but instead of having everyone use the public key to talk to us, we're using our private key to talk to them. And what we're telling them is that, yes, this is really from me. So in our example, like A wants to tell B to pay something, and we want to have B verify that that really does come from A and not from someone else. So B will get the message and the signature and compute sort of the verified version of that. You compute the verify function on the public key that they got previously, the signature and the message that it was supposed to be produced over, and see if it matches. And the verify function will return 1 if it does. And if we had an attacker who tried to change this message here, then it's going to be give us a 0 instead of a 1. If we had an attacker that tried to manipulate the signature instead, it will still give a 0, right? It's not going to be feasible for them to figure out how the signature changes when you change the message without the private key. Question? Yes. Question, can you not deduce the private key from messages and signatures? So the way all our asymmetric encryption and digital signature functions are going to work is there's going to actually be a way of solving this for the private key. That is actually possible. But that's not going to be computationally feasible to compute if the mathematician who gave us these functions did that correctly. So we're not relying on it not being mathematically possible to compute the private key. We're relying on it taking, you know, so long that your algorithms class would say, don't do this, ever. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we have now all these tools for doing encryption and authentication, and we had some examples on the quiz of like, well, we have to use them carefully, but it seems like the main thing that happened on the quiz is that we did this stupid thing and didn't just encrypt and authenticate everything. Surely, you know, if we just do that, our lives will be easy. And it seems like that would be true, but there are lots of ways of messing up after encrypting and authenticating everything, either with a digital signature or a message authentication code. And this is not intuitive, right? It seems like, oh gosh, we're verifying that the message came from the right place, we're keeping anyone else from reading it. How is that gonna, you know, get us in actual trouble against this machine in the middle attacker we talked about earlier? Surely they can't do anything. But the answer is they can, and that's going to be, you know, related to if we aren't careful about how we use the encryption authentication function. So let's start with a simple example of I'm just going to use digital signatures because all we care about is authenticity. And we're using this for a chat program here. And simplest version of the scheme is that we send a message and it's signature. Great. So A is talking to B, B is talking to A in our chat program. They have public keys and private keys, and we just distribute all the public keys in advance, and we sign every single message, verify it before we show it to the user. And the idea here is that our attacker is never going to be able to make a message between us go wrong. So there's a problem here. So here we have our communication. You know, A is saying, Mio, did you order lunch? Oh, yeah, I did. Vegetarian, nope, not this time. And then, you know, later, oh, there's the guy at the door to repair the AC. Should I let him in? What can the attacker do here? Well, attacker can't, yeah.
It can use either signature one or signature two to say yes or no.
Yeah, so they can use, yeah, so the attacker can choose their response by just copying this previous message on its signature. The signature is valid, it's going to go through the verify function, it's going to pass. So our machine in the middle attacker can do what's called a replay attack, that they have a completely valid signature that they can just use again. So our problem here is that though we have confidentiality and authenticity for each individual message, like we aren't thinking about the context of the message, and we need to encode that context in the thing we have authenticity over. I guess we don't have confidentiality, we have authenticity, but we don't have authenticity about the context. The messages can be, and a clever attacker will take them out of context. Yes?
If you have like a stream, couldn't you like encrypt the like sequence number so it can see that they're out of order?
So a question, couldn't we like have some sequence numbers see out of order? That would be our main solution to this problem. Yes. So this gives us, you know, kind of the, you know, this is our attack. The attacker can just take that earlier message, reuse it. And I have this as a kind of toy example, but this comes up kind of by accident all the time when people try to use encryption and authentication in systems, that they often don't think carefully about, wait, how can this message be reused out of context, out of the original context, and how will I interpret it then? So the general solutions to replay attacks are usually nonces, which stands for number used once. The simplest version of this is probably a counter. So we just have counters for each message. And in order for this to work, we need to have whatever chat client we're using actually check the numbers, which is an easy mistake to make and not test. But as long as you actually check the numbers, now the attacker can't put this message in here because A's client will look at it and say, that's not a valid message, I'm going to ignore it. Yes? So the question is, like, here I'm not doing encryption. Shouldn't we just fix this by doing encryption? And I think, because how would the attacker know what message to use? And I think in many practical scenarios, the attacker can figure out from other information about what message to use. So for example, let's say we're thinking about like encrypted emails. What an attacker might do is they might send you an email and they can guess what you're gonna do after you get that. Then they can guess, oh, this message is probably has this information based on the email I sent you and that you acted on. So they can, often in real scenarios, you have to kind of assume the attacker can figure out the contents of certain messages. I think it's realistic to assume that because usually the attacker like has some information about what you're doing and can influence you in some like completely legitimate ways. Does that answer your question? Yeah, but I agree, like, it would make it harder for the attacker if we encrypted everything. Other questions? Yeah, the other example I give for this chat case is, like, if you meet A socially and look over and see what messages they sent, that would be a very other plausible way to do it. Especially since we're doing this on messages that aren't sensitive at all. Other questions? And so this counter is one idea. So an annoyance of this scheme, is that we have to like keep track of this number the whole time. And if we ever like go back to one, then we have a problem. Like we can never reset back to one unless we like change keys or something or change something else. Another solution is that we can choose random numbers and have A tell B the next number B should use and B tell A the next number A should use each time. And since we choose a new number each time, the attacker can never substitute the another message. And this scheme, it's more complicated, but it means that we don't have to save the counter somewhere for the scheme to work. Okay. So this was one type of missing context here. So here the context we were missing is where in the conversation the message was. Another version of this we can have is that if we sign things that are missing who the message is for. So if B talks to M, gets a yes response with a signature, with what I've shown you, M can just copy this response that happens to have the same number, which seems like a thing you could arrange if you're typing messages to someone. And make it work. So we're going to want to solve this problem. So what would be a good solution to avoid this issue? There are multiple, probably reasonable solutions.
Again, where you could have them say who they're
So you gave two solutions. So one solution is you could say, oh, this other way of doing nonces, like, that's not a problem, because that seems like it's not a problem. This actually doesn't, yes, this would work because this doesn't work in the online sense. So the problem with that is that, well, it works in this case because M had to do the conversation in advance. If M can do this in real time, we have the problem that, well, then A is going to send, like, next number Q, let's say. If B can, N can send, did you order lunch, next number Q, in that conversation, which can't be earlier now. But if they can do it after they get the message from A and before, it's still a problem, but it does mean that they can't prepare it in advance. So that doesn't quite work, but the other solution you had, which is, I think, the simpler one conceptually, is that we just, we just mark each of these messages with who they're for. We just say, this is 50, comma, B. This is 50, comma, M. This is 50, comma, B. And now that signature won't work here because A is expecting a 50, comma, A message and can know to reject that if that doesn't match. Again, we have to actually check this field, but that's, I think, the simpler strategy is that we just write down who the message is for, and basically, intuitively, any context about the message, if you want authenticity, it has to be part of what you sign. So you don't just sign the message, you sign all the information you need to know what the message means. You can't rely on that being kind of outside of it. You need to make sure that you can't interpret one signature as something else. Another solution that's our example is that we could just generate new public keys, public and private keys, for each group we talk to. That's another kind of mitigation of this problem. And I showed this attack with digital signatures. We can have the same issues with message authentication codes with what are called reflection attacks. That even though, like, only A and B share a key, our attacker can take a message that A sent to B and pretend it was sent from B to A. So, if we were doing A to B, Q, yes, and a map, well, we can just copy this and say it's from B to A. And because the message authentication code, right, uses a shared key that is the same, would be the same in both directions if we didn't take precautions, that would be a problem. One fix for reflection attacks is that we can, again, write down who we're talking to in the message. The other is that we could use different keys for different directions, even though that's not otherwise necessary. So questions about our replay attacks here. And as I mentioned earlier, like, kind of a lot of my motivation in doing or talking about cryptography in this class is I want to make it so you might use a cryptography library without sort of breaking things. And a big, what I feel, misconception that often happens when people learn about cryptography, especially more math-focused approaches, is people are very focused on, oh, you can break the encryption algorithm. You can break the message authentication code, you could break the digital signature. And yeah, sometimes that's true, but not very often. Most of the problems with real systems are we're using these secure tools insecurely, like these replay attacks I'm showing you here. And to give kind of more other examples, so I'll give just some examples to, like, give you an idea of, like, the things I would worry about being wrong when you're using encryption versus, you know, I wouldn't worry so much about, oh, someone's going to break AES with only 128 bits because there's this more secure one. That's not what I'd worry about. I'd worry about stupider problems. So as an example, there were some broken implementations of TLS. TLS is the sort of most common way of encrypting connections to, among other things, websites. And the protocol, you know, we'll talk about it in more detail later, has basically two steps. It has a step of verify server identity. After you do that, then you receive messages from the server. So straightforward, we verify the identity, then we receive encrypted messages. We don't start receiving encrypted messages and processing them until we know we're getting them from the right place. So there was a broken TLS library focused on embedded systems where they had a little bug. And basically, the server could send a message from step two, and the way the code worked is that they had a, you know, message equals get message, and they had if message.type equals, you know, verify, do the verify stuff, else if message.type equals receive, do the receive stuff. They didn't check whether they did the verify stuff before the receive stuff. So a server that just skipped a step could convince them to skip that all that verifying stuff. So this is like not a bug, which is like not a mathematical bug, but this is a very common type of bug in cryptography software, is this kind of logic error. Which it's very understandable why it happened. Right, you can think of, oh yeah, we received the message. We must be in the receiving message code. Let's run the receiving message code. And also, if you think of testing this, right? Well, all the servers work by doing the verifying stuff before the receiving message stuff. So they never tested this case. Another example, it would be in the multi-user chat system Matrix. And Matrix intended to have this end-to-end encryption, meaning that things are encrypted, say, on my phone, and decrypted on, say, on the person's phone I'm talking to, and never decrypted in the middle. To make this work, we need to somehow get the keys that my phone has to the other person's phone. And there's a problem that, you know, if I get a new phone, we need to get them my new keys. And so they have this whole system for, you know, verifying that, you know, when I add a new phone, that it's my new phone, and like saying, hey, this user has new keys and they've been verified with another, you know, I verified with my old phone, my new phone. And I have a way of sending that information. And the idea is that there's a signature that's going to tell you, oh yes, the old phone verified the new phone's okay. We use a digital signature for this, verifies authenticity, seems great. The bug that they had is that they didn't check that signature. They didn't look for it, they just accepted the keys. So a server in the middle here could just send whatever keys they wanted. So that's my brief sort of cautionary tale. Like, these are the things I'd worry first about when doing cryptography, not like, am I using enough bits in my key? Like, yes, am I using enough bits in my key? And other things about, did I choose the right functions from the mathematical experts matter, but they aren't the thing that's most likely to get you in trouble. And we have a lab on this, I believe, next week. And it's focused on doing things like replay attacks. So you're going to play a machine in the middle. The scenario in the lab is that A and B are sending messages about how much money to pay you, playing M. And your goal is to change that number. And there are scenarios of increasing difficulty where you can do things like replay attacks or just sending your own message to handle that. So I'm going to get back to a problem I talked about earlier next. I guess I should take the questions about the lab for anyone who's like looked at it, or questions about our replay attacks before I move on to kind of a more, yes, some more how do things work topic. So one thing we're kind of missing so far is that I said, okay, we have these public keys and we still need to get all the public keys. And I had all these steps where I said, oh, we're going to securely send these public keys. That's easier than securely sending shared secrets, because at least we don't have to worry about keeping them a secret. They can be public, as the name suggests. But we still need to get them. And one thing that we do practically is that, well, we use encryption for talking to websites. And we'd like it when you talk to your browser talks to a website, that it has the public key of the website you're talking to. That's what we're going to use to make that work. It's easier to get that than a shared secret, but it's still too hard for millions of websites out there for your browser to like have all the public keys. So we use this idea where your browser has a smaller set of public keys, and we use that to bootstrap the public keys of the websites you're talking to. And this idea is going to be one known as a certificate. So kind of the basis here is that rather than you knowing the public key directly, we'd like to ask someone else for the public key. So we're going to do a variation of that. But we're going to do something that's more efficient than that by taking advantage of how digital signatures work. So the idea is that, you know, let's say A has B's public key, and C knows A and wants B's public key. Well, what we could do is we could have C contact A and say, hey, B's key, and A could send back to C, you know, B's key. Now, the problem is that if we're thinking about an attacker, right, the attacker could manipulate that. That would be bad. So we're going to want to also have a signature from A. Key. And something that specifies the context, which is that B's key and that it's B's public key, not someone else's public key. Right, that's how we securely communicate that. And we're gonna call basically this message, which I'm kind of representing more explicitly here, a certificate for B. This is a message from A, which tells us that A is promising that as far as they know, B's public key is this. And it has a digital signature, so we know that this message was generated by A, or someone who stole A's private key. And instead of having C ask A for this message, what we can do is we can have A generate this message in advance and hand it to B. Then B can hand it, in this case, to C. And basically, this is as if, you know, C talked to B and B talked to A on behalf of C and then talked back. But we kind of skip that step. We just get the thing we need from A in advance rather than need to talk to A every time. And we give it to B, which is, you know, where we want it anyways, because if we want to talk to B, we need to know B's public key. So now B has the information to let us verify that if we trust A. So we call this a certificate. So B is sending that certificate. And if C trusts A, that certificate tells C, hey, I know B's public key. If C doesn't trust A, well, it's not useful. And we'll call this scheme, in the scheme we'll say that CA is a certificate authority. And this is a way where we can distribute public keys, assuming that we can trust some number of certificate authorities. And this is what sort of web browsers do to get public keys for websites, that the web browsers have some number of certificate authorities. Websites go to some certificate authority, get one of these certificates, and when your web browser connects to a website, the website sends back a certificate. Your web browser checks, did this really come from one of the certificate authorities I know about? And as for where do the certificate authorities come from, well, they're just shipped with the web browser. And because there's only a few hundred of them, that's something we can do. If we want to talk about like shipping the public keys of all possible websites, there's like millions of those, and they change all the time. So that's not something we can do. Some questions about this certificate authority idea? Yeah. Question, if C was going to talk to B, how can I go through A first? So it doesn't in our final version of the scheme. But we need to get these public keys somehow. So the naive way of doing this is that if we knew that A knew B's key, we could just ask A for it. The shortcut we're going to take is rather than doing that, we're just going to talk to B directly like you want, and B is going to forward that message from A that was generated in advance. But this is kind of substituting for us actually asking A for the key. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
But if C doesn't know B's public key, how can it talk to B in the first place to get that?
Question, if C doesn't know B's public key, how can it talk to B in the first place? So generally, C will talk in a way where it doesn't have verified the identity. And once it gets the certificate, then it can use that to verify that, oh, the person I guessed was B is actually B. So in the case of like a website, we will use DNS to find the address to contact. We'll send a message to that address, but we're not sure it's really going to the right place yet. But when we get back the certificate and some digital signatures, we will just say, yes, I actually contacted the right place. Yeah, so that's a good question. Yeah, like, how do we verify that we don't know? Yeah, we in fact talk to people who we're not sure about. Other questions? Okay. So here's an example of a certificate, an old certificate, as you can tell. This is not the actual format. It's actually in a surprisingly complex binary format. But this is a dump from OpenSSL, which knows how to write it out in kind of readable way. So we can see we have a serial number. We have information about how it's digitally signed. And it says, oh, this was issued by this certificate authority, something called the In Common RSA Server CA. It's valid for a year from 2023 to 2024 in this case. And it's for canvas.its.virginia.edu. And well, actually, for reasons that are historical, the place where the name of it's for is actually in an extension called the subject alternate name, just for silly historical reasons. And this here is just kind of metadata that the browser could show you maybe, but not what the browser is actually checking, which is this field. Now, this is like the information, like, so we have our, you know, metadata, but we also need like, the important thing is not just who the certificate is for and when it's valid, but we also need to have a public key. So we're going to have that in there. I've truncated it here because this is actually pretty long. And we're going to have a digital signature, which is going to be a signature over not just the public key, But the public key and all that identity information and the information about what certificate authority it is. So a signature over everything else in the certificate. And so this is what last year Canvas sent, and I think this year it's something similar, just with a different year in the certificate, most likely, and probably a different serial number. And this is what your web browser gets. So what we think would happen here is that the web browser, first thing we're going to do is we're going to take this whole certificate, all the data, information about the identity and so on, and check this digital signature. We're going to run it through the verify function. So, you know, we're going to run V of all this data here, or V of the sort of the public key for the CA, all of this data here, and the signature, and check that it equals one. You know, that's going to be what our browser is going to do with this certificate. And if it doesn't equal one, we're just going to drop the connection and say, you connected to the wrong website. Something is wrong. And modern browsers generally display a scary interstitial message that's hard to click through when that happens. Historically, they maybe displayed a not very scary message and made this very ineffective. Okay. So questions about our certificate verification procedure? Okay, so there's something I told you that isn't quite right. And I implied that, we're going to be able to look at our browser and find out that it has an entry for this certificate authority sort of shipped with it, or maybe our OS has it instead, but our machine already has a copy of the public key for this certificate authority. That's a very reasonable assumption. This is the certificate for Canvas. We can connect to Canvas securely. Surely that's how that works. But there's an extra layer of indirection going on. And that we're going to actually have two certificates involved here. That instead of just having the certificate for this CA, from this CA and that CA's public key, we don't have that. So we need to get the public key of the in-common RSA server CA that signed the Canvas certificate. The way we're going to do that is that we're going to get a second certificate that comes from somewhere else saying, this is really the certificate of this CA. And you should trust this CA to verify websites. And that certificate, at least at the title of this slide, was signed by something called the User Trust RSA Certification Authority. And that was actually shipped with browsers or OSs. You might say, why are there so many organizations involved? Well, it's only actually one. They're both now owned by the UK-based company Sectigo. At least that was when I wrote this slide 6 months ago. I hope that hasn't changed. But we have this problem that certificate authorities last a very long time. So even though user trust doesn't exist anymore, it's certainly the name of that certificate authority. And so if we could have sort of certificates for other CAs, we got this hierarchy of certificates. So you have these different certificate authorities. They have these names in the certificates, which might not have much to do with how they actually work. So in the case of User Trust, it was originally operated by a company called User Trust, which was then bought in 2004. This is a very old CA. By a company called Komodo, which was then renamed to Sectigo. But the name can't change because it's in all the digital signatures, so it stays the same. And InCommon is run by Sectigo, but is actually a separate organization that's part of Internet 2 that contracts out running this certificate authority. And that's who signs most University of Virginia certificates, There's a whole bunch of other certificate authorities run by different companies. In some cases, we have, you know, a certificate authority run by one company signing another company certificate. So we have the example here where GlobalSign is one company that has a certificate saying you should trust DGS R1, which is run by Google, to verify websites. And they've done that to enable us to switch from one certificate authority to another, basically. And we have this hierarchy, and some subset of these are going to be included in browsers or OSs. So in this example, most browsers or OSs you know of will probably have a copy of this user trust cert and this global sign cert. Ones that aren't very old will also have a copy of this GTS root R1 cert. And because the older ones don't, that's why they have a certificate from GlobalSign to handle those devices that don't have a copy of it already. And that's how we kind of transition from one certificate authority to another most commonly. And the name you often see for these certificate authorities that are shipped with your browsers or OSs is Trust Anchors, because we're trusting them. Note that I said trust, not trustworthiness anchors. I'm just saying we trust them in that your browser will say, yes, this is the website that's the website because it says so. It's not like checking, not because they're necessarily worthy of being trusted for that. And I have my old numbers. I probably should update these sometimes. It might have gone down. But there's a surprising number of them. So as of last year, there were 155 operated by 55 different organizations in Firefox, more in Windows. I'm guessing that number has gone down slightly, but probably not by much. So there's a surprising number of these, and these could basically sign a certificate for any website, and your browser will just use them. Which might seem like not so great that we have 55 entities that can do that, but that's how it is. So we have this, what we'll call an ecosystem with certificate authorities, and everyone kind of gets certificates. And this idea is called a public key infrastructure. And the most well-known public key infrastructure is the one for the web, but there are others out there. Often, like, you might run one like within your organization for encrypted email would be an example. So that would be like separate from any other company. So you could have this independent. There's one of these for verifying domain name records that's kind of used. When we think about like app stores verifying that the application comes from the right place, often Apple and Google and so on will run their own public key infrastructure, not for the purpose of verifying websites, but for the purpose of verifying application programs. So we have this public key infrastructure, and a good question might be, how do you get a public key? Like, what is the certificate authority, or, you know, so how do certificate authorities check identity? What are they checking before they issue a certificate? So why can't I just go to Zeptigo and ask them to please give me a certificate for google.com? Why won't they do that? So has anyone actually gotten a certificate for something and knows what you did to verify it was for the right website that you actually controlled and not like you weren't like getting a certificate for google.com? Yeah.
Maybe you
could change something on the web page. So that is, yes, that is a common thing that actually is done. Is that what you did, or just you heard of that happening?
I just heard of it.
You've heard of it happening. So that is one of the procedures that's allowed. And this might concern you because, like, How is that really different than like I going to the web page randomly and not knowing where it is? But that's kind of where the standards are. So there's an organization called the CA Browser Forum, which specifies the rules for what you do to verify certificates in order to have your certificate authority included in the browsers. So they have the rules for what CAs should do. If CAs don't follow that rule, those rules, they just remove them from the browsers. And the main way that they verify identity is that they choose a random value and either look up the domain contact, like email or postal address, and send that value to them and verify that it was received, or they check for it being put into a DNS record somewhere, like as a special domain name, or put in a website somewhere. And this, like, you know, doesn't necessarily handle issues where, like, you can intercept someone's email, or where you can fool routers to have the wrong routing table sometimes. Like, it doesn't, like, directly verify that you're the one who signed up for the domain. But that's what we do. And you might say, like, this doesn't look that much different than what my browser is doing to contact the website. And in some cases, maybe that's true. In some cases, maybe it is different because we're, like, not going through an insecure Wi-Fi network to do this, at least. Right? We're coming from some corporate network that's hopefully more stable. So I would say that, like, it's kind of bizarre how loose these requirements are, but there are things that CAs do that I think are kind of, you know, more interesting, you know, remarkable as far as, you know, providing security and, like, make this a more practical thing. So one of the things that I think makes this more practical is that one of the things CAs are obliged to do is have a public record of all certificates they have issued. And this is checked by browsers. So many browsers, if you go to a website and it isn't in one of these public records, it will say that certificate's invalid. And what this lets you do is that if you operate google.com and someone gets a certificate for it who wasn't supposed to, well, you can check these public records periodically and say something happened bad here. And this also encourages CAs to make their verification effective because, well, their mistakes are going to be very provable. Other things CAs do is that they're required to, like, keep their keys in sort of very secure in tamper-resistant machines. So the idea is that it shouldn't be possible for, like, a rogue CA, rogue employee of one of these companies to, like, get a copy of the private key and make their own certificates. And a way that that's done is by having hardware that it is hard to remove things from without it being noticed. And something else that they do is that you can revoke certificates. Now, there's a problem here, that this procedure I gave you for what browsers do has no step where we check if the certificate was revoked that I told you. So what do we actually do for that? And browsers sometimes will contact the CA to check. Another thing that will happen is browsers sometimes will get updates with a list of revoked certificates that they'll check against. And they'll get those updates via, like, the normal way you get browser updates. So that's my sort of talk about how certificates are actually issued and how we actually verify websites. Okay. Questions? Okay, so I'm going to talk about a couple other cryptographic tools. So everything, we've talked about all the things we need for confidentiality and authenticity. But there are some other things that you're likely to come across in practice, and which is for these first two, cryptographic hash functions and secure random numbers, And there's another thing here called key agreement, which we're going to need to talk about how TLS actually works, since I think that's something that we probably want to know, since it's used all the time everywhere. And it's also similar to like how SSH works, even though it's not the same as SSH, for example. So let's start first talk about cryptographic hash functions. So one thing you'll notice if you look up digital signature functions is that they typically have a size limit. You typically can't sign an infinitely long message with the kind of raw signature function. So a tool will often want in these sorts of scenarios is a way to get a secure summary of the message. So our secure summary is going to be basically a hash of the message, but we can't just use any hash function because if we're passing it as sort of a substitute for the message to the digital signature, it needs to be the case that we can't have hash collisions be generated by an adversary. If I sign the message, you know, pay $1,000, and the way I sign that is by hashing it, then signing the hash, it would be really bad if pay $1,000 hashes to the same thing as pay $1,384 or something like that. So a cryptographic hash is going to be kind of a secure summary of the value that, you know, it means that, you know, it's going to be secure in the sense that if we know the hash, we can't reverse it. It should be impractical to reverse it. Obviously, it's possible. If we can guess what the message is, we can verify the hash matches. But if we can't guess it, we shouldn't be able to reverse it. So practically what this means is that reversing the hash is as hard as guessing all the possible values. And also, it should be hard to find a new message with the same hash. And that's really important for our digital signature case. We don't want to sign one thing and have an attacker generate a second thing that has the same signature. And if we're substituting this summary for the whole message because we can't sign huge things, that's not going to work. And I mentioned this being used for digital signatures where the sign function just doesn't take large messages. That's like one common use. Another common use is that this is a relatively simple way of making message authentication codes. That we said message authentication codes were kind of like a key hash. One way you can make a key hash is by starting with a secure hash and just hashing a key and the data in some way. And that's basically one of the more common ways of making message authentication codes. So one special scenario where hashing comes up is for passwords. And you might be surprised that if you know about like password hashing, that I didn't list it down here, right? Why didn't I list it as an example use? And the idea of password hashing is that if I'm storing passwords, I would really like it to be the case that someone who gets my list of passwords for like my website doesn't know the passwords right away, but I can still verify them. And hashes, cryptographic hashes, let me do that. Because in order for them to find the passwords from the hashes, they would have to reverse this. And this is really good, for example, if I'm running a website that people log into and they use the same password on some other website. We'd really like it to be the case that when my website gets hacked, that the other website doesn't also get hacked as a result. And using these hashes should prevent that. And we'd also like it to be the case that like I can keep using my password and probably not be in trouble. But there's a problem here, which is that I didn't specify any sort of efficiency requirement. And if we just want a cryptographic hash for like making signatures, we're going to choose the fastest one that's still secure. But that's not going to be secure for a password case because we can try a billion passwords really fast if it's fast. And that's actually bad for passwords. A lot of people do not have a password in their format where there's not a billion possibilities. And we'd still like that to kind of mostly be secure. So there's kind of these special cryptographic hash functions built for password hashing that basically modify a secure hash function to be deliberately slower and more resource intensive. And this is to make it so when we have to guess passwords and see if they match, that's slower than it would be otherwise. And you don't get this if you just look for a hash function. You have to look for one of these special types that has this added deliberate slowness. Yeah?
And that's just for the sake that like, an attacker can't guess a ton of passwords and figure out what people's passwords are?
Yeah, that's just for the sake that an attacker can't guess a ton of passwords and figure out what people's passwords are? Yeah. So, and the observation I make is that like that's not something we care about with message authentication codes or digital signatures, right? It's that we don't really care about the attacker guessing a ton of things there. But here we do. Yeah. And for passwords, this is a real big concern because, because it's very practical, especially with like GPUs and so on, to guess, if we don't use one of these, to guess trillions or quadrillion, trillions of passwords over like a day easily, or probably quadrillions over a day. So that was cryptographic hashing. We talked about generating keys, public keys, private keys, and shared secrets. And it's important that these actually be secret, that other people don't know them. And there's a problem here that we have to generate something other people don't know. And generally the way we want to do that is we want to make a random number. And by random, what we mean in this case is that it's random in the sense that other people cannot predict the value. So this means that some ways you might generate random numbers for, say, a simulation are very bad. Like a common thing you might do in a game that you definitely shouldn't do in this sort of context is you might seed a random number generator with the time. The time is pretty predictable. Yes, we might have it down to the second, or maybe even the microsecond. There's still not that many possibilities. So that's not going to be acceptable here. And also, if you know how SRAN works, this is a 32-bit number. There's only so many 32-bit numbers. And we could just try all of that. So that's not going to be acceptable. So often, we're going to want these random numbers that are what we'll call cryptographically secure, where the attacker can't guess them better than chance. Of course, they're sometimes going to get lucky about something. And also, we generally want it to be the case that knowing the prior numbers shouldn't help you know the later numbers. So this, is a problem with many kind of how, like, your simple random number generators often will have this property that if you know how it works, you can figure out what the sequence will be, from the prior numbers. We don't want that property here. And we also generally want it to be the case that if you compromise the machine, that shouldn't reveal older numbers that aren't on the machine. So how can we make that work? We will talk about that briefly next time and then go into talking about TLS.